The Evolve Network is now live at evolvenetwork.tv. Subscribe for meal plans, recipes, cooking shows, and our very own The Magic Pill and The Magic Plant, as well as access to my favourite documentaries. The Evolve Network is also home to our full library of podcasts, with new release podcasts airing first and in full on the channel. You can also watch selected vodcasts in a video format. Meanwhile, enjoy this highlight of our podcast and head over to evolvenetwork.tv for the full Evolve podcast experience. The Evolve with Pete Evans podcast is a conversation about my favourite ingredients for a healthy human experience. We take an informed look at topics that include nutritional and emotional well-being, as well as expanded consciousness. I love exploring the topics that are not traditionally taught at school and take a deep dive into them with my special guests. I invite you to sit back and come along for the ride with an open mind and heart, and please share with your family and friends, as these podcasts may just be the seed from which many things will flourish from. Cheers. We've been using Waters Co. water filters for the last 10 years, and I wholeheartedly trust my family's health with them. Waters Co., established 1977, have personal and domestic water filters, which turns your ordinary tap water into great-tasting, alkaline, ionized mineral water, which removes up to 99.9% of fluoride, heavy metals, chemicals, and bacteria, so you can love your tap water again. The Bio 1000 is the latest edition of the BMP 1000 model and the culmination of over 40 years of experience and research into water filtration by some of the world's leading scientists. Waters Co. was first to market with natural gravity-fed systems, creating alkaline water way back in 1984, and have continued to lead the market in research and development, setting the benchmark for all other brands to follow. Please go to my webpage at peteevans.com to learn more and to receive your special discount from my link on the products page. You're going to love it. Ben, thank you so much for joining us. How are you, brother?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I feel like we've got a lot to talk about. We seem to have walked similar paths with major censorship and attacks from all sides. And yeah. Here you are. You're still doing what you love to do and standing tall. Yeah. What does that? I mean, one of the questions I keep getting asked is, why do you do what you do, and how can you keep going with all the attacks? And mm-hmm. I'd love to ask you that question. Has there been times when you've thought that, this is all too difficult, all too hard, I can't keep doing this anymore, or have you been rock solid?
Well, I'll say it this way. So, I actually was thinking literally today about this very question, which is, how much easier life would have been to have taken a different path. Just stick with the mainstream broadcast career that was laid out in front of me. And that's the path I could have stayed on, and it would have been a lot easier. The problem is, of course, is that you have to, at the end of your life, look back on who you were and what you became and what you did with the voice that you had. And in my case, I don't think there's any other way. I mean, how do you stop? How do you not continue to go forward, especially in this moment? There's this incredible story that you may or may not know that comes out of the book of Esther. And there's a very famous line from it, which is, for such a time as this, you were brought to this place. And that's how I feel about so many people right now, that a lot of us who have been in this space, who have questioned, why do I have to go through this? Why can't I just, get up and tell people the truth and not be, have to live through such attacks, and your integrity attacked and your credibility attacked, having horrible things written about you online, and having the people with all the power attacking you, right? And so, but I don't know what else to do. I don't know what else I would be. I don't know where else I could go. What other path is there? Because the fact is, you can't unknow what you know. You can't unlearn what you've learned. And so as you're moving in this path, as you're moving in this moment that we're in right now, I just don't see how there's any other path. So let me back up just a little bit. I think prior to COVID, I had already experienced so many attacks for so many different stories I'd done over the years, and focusing on, foreign policy and drone strikes and wars around the world and, the Syrian civil war. It was just there was so much to talk about and had been beaten up, you know, so repeatedly over my career, but nothing comes close to what the last 18 months have been like in terms of just watching the kind of consolidation of power, the consolidation of censorship, the consolidation of the smear machine, all really focusing and micro-focusing on taking out any opposition. So it's an incredible moment that we're in, and I'm pretty proud to be standing in it right now.
I'm glad you're here too, brother. I want to ask you, it's interesting because most of the people that I have on the program are doctors, I would say, as a broad stroke of the people that I interview. And one of the questions I always ask them is, why did you go into medicine, or why did you go into the healing arts, and explain medicine for me, your definition of medicine. It is beautiful, because and subsequently, what is the definition of health or healing?
Yeah.
And I'd love to ask you, how did you get into journalism, and what is your definition of journalism / media? Because I love the name of your company, Truth and Media, and your platform. So talk to us about what got young Ben excited about telling stories telling the truth.
Well, I was going to say, so actually my story starts off in a very uninspirational way, in that early on, I started my career in TV as a news videographer, a news photographer is what we called them at the time, but it was actually a videographer, and then kind of moved up. But the honest truth is, I got into the business because I needed a job. I needed to make money. And so I was behind the camera because I needed a job. And I had three brothers who were news videographers, and they said, hey, here's something that we do and we like it. Maybe you'd like it too. I tried it. I was pretty good at it. So I did it. And then I got married really young. I got married at 20 years old, and I had my first daughter before I was 21. And I said, I need to make better money than this. And so I worked really hard to get in front of the camera. No great story here of wanting to save the world and change the world. I literally wanted to support my family. And I spent the first, you know, few years of my career just efforting to make as much money as I could, to get to the highest level that I could. My career arc, my career path was supposed to take me, you know, here in the US, my goal was to get to Fox News and to work for Fox News and be an anchor in New York. And that was kind of my dream path, or to go and just be a host, do hosting duties on TV and make a whole bunch of money doing that, and be a celebrity. And that was kind of how I viewed my life. And it wasn't until I had been a news anchor for a few years and was really efforting to stay on this path that I was confronted. I'm originally from El Paso, Texas. So for your viewers, Texas, right on the border with Mexico, and El Paso itself is the primary city. The largest border plex in the world is Ciudad Juarez, which is the city of Juarez on the Mexican side. El Paso, Texas, on the U.S. side, it's the largest border metroplex in the world. 4 million people on either side of the border living in this space. And so I grew up there, and I had been working there, and all of a sudden there was a huge drug war that came to Mexico, and specifically to this city. And at the time, this was around 2007, Juarez became the most deadly city in the world. There were more people dying in Juarez than there were dying in Baghdad at the time. There were more journalists being killed there than any place in the world. And so, again, I wasn't a particularly, you know, gung-ho, I want to be the truth teller. But I have always told the truth as a journalist. It just wasn't like, you know, this quest of mine. And I was a broadcaster, I would say, more than anything. And then when this drug war hit, I began to go over into Mexico and cover what was happening, and began to see how horrific this drug war was and the impact it was having on people's lives, on the entire community. Violence begetting violence, watching it from, you know, what the media was saying about it on the national level, which they were claiming it was a drug war, therefore it was only drug narcos fighting each other, which is absolutely not true, and ignoring the tens of thousands of people whose lives were being wrecked by this war. And so I started really trying to not just cover what was happening and understand it at kind of a granular level, but also to help educate journalists who were coming into this part of the world from all over the world to cover this drug war. And what I found was that they didn't care, that the media companies that were coming down to cover this war, they had no interest in what was really happening or why it was happening. They had a narrative that they wanted to push. And so I experienced that. My wife got tired of me being over there because she said, "You're going to get killed." I actually was almost kidnapped at one point. She said, "We need to get out of here." And so I took a job instead in the most boring city in the world. I moved to from El Paso, Texas, in the most deadly, you know, city in the world in Juarez, and went to Cincinnati, Ohio, which was just the most boring place, and worked for the Fox station there covering city council. And it was just horrible. I was the main anchor of their Fox station. But what I didn't realize, this was in 2011, the beginning of 2011, was that we were on the verge of another presidential election. And Ohio is the swing state of swing states in the United States. And every presidential candidate began to come through the state. And so because I was working for a Fox station, had a chance as their main anchor to interview all these different presidential candidates, had a chance to interview the sitting president, Barack Obama, at one point. And part of my journey was, you know, covering a guy by the name of Ron Paul, who was a congressman running for president. And viewers who saw that I actually covered him started messaging me and saying, "We're shocked that you would cover this guy, this Congressman Ron Paul." And I said, "Why?" And they said, "Well, because the media won't talk about him because he criticizes the wars. He's against, you know, a lot of the big government waste, against the Federal Reserve and the banking system." I didn't know any of these things. And so I began to find out what he was about and what he believed, and began to see that he really was being censored. And realized it was the things he was talking about. And so I began to have a journey as a journalist that collided with a reality, I guess a reality check of my own, that the industry that I was in was a dishonest industry. It was not truthful in the kinds of stories we covered. It was not truthful in the opinions that were put out over the air, in the facts that were communicated to the public. It was not truthful. And so the more I began to see that, the more I realized that the problem isn't just that we have a left-right divide in this country, which I think is mostly fake, but the real reality is that there's a few people who are manipulating this media entity in the world. And there were very few journalists left. In fact, what I began to see for the next 10 years of my career was that most people who call themselves journalists are not journalists. They're either activists at the high levels of, you know, the Washington Post, New York Times, CNN, CBS, or if they're in local television, they're broadcasters. They're not journalists, meaning they've never been taught how to question things and how to look at a story and say, you know, rather than just accepting the press release that comes from some authority figure, questioning it, challenging it. They don't know how to do that. They literally have not been taught how to do it. And so for me, it was a process of just realizing that everything around me was fake. Everything was masquerading as fact, and it wasn't. And so that kind of, you know, began that journey for me as well. So the first 10 years of my career, I'd say were relatively lackluster. I would say the next 10 years, one day after the next, it was like chasing the white rabbit. It was finding out just how fake this industry was, and then working to reveal that using technology to people out there who also recognize, I think, in the public that it's fake.
What a journey. Very similar, actually, in when I became a chef. It was just to get a job, and then to go up the ladder. It was how far could I go up this ladder to make money so I don't go broke, so I can look after things. And then the spark happened. Then I fell in love with it because I understood what it was for, what yes. food was actually for. And it took me a long time to find out that it actually we could use it as a tool for health. We could use it as a tool for self-love. We could use it as a tool, as a gift to family and friends. And then part of that was we can educate people, you know, to see food as something beyond just a delicious morsel that we put into our mouths. And it's so fascinating because so many of the doctors that we've interviewed over the years had the same thing. They go into medicine for a certain reason, and then they realize that what they're being taught isn't exactly the truth in all aspects. So then they further their education to understand how alternative practices or alternative medicine or natural medicine. So they start to incorporate that into what they've learned to be able to help their patients for getting off their pharmaceuticals. And then they find the wrath of the industry, so to speak, because they're actually helping people. So I want to understand when you found out, I mean, it was probably a gradual process for you over those 10 years that the industry, would you say it was corrupt, or would you just say it had lost its integrity?
I would say that it first lost its integrity and then became corrupted. And I think most industries, and you'd probably agree with this, most industries follow that pattern, right? Which is that first you begin to say, well, in media, for instance, you know, if you go back into the 1940s and 50s and newspapers, and then when television first came along, you know, news programs didn't sell advertising. They actually, TV networks lost money on the news portion of their broadcast, but they did it for the public interest. And then there was a show here in the United States. I know there's a version in Australia called 60 Minutes, right? And 60 Minutes completely changed the game because it was the first news program that actually made money for a network. They sold advertising. There were so many people watching it on Sunday nights, CBS in the United States. And so they began to sell advertising, and then network executives figured out, hey, we can make money from this thing. All of a sudden, it completely shifted the paradigm of what media was able to do. Now you don't just create newscasts for the sake of educating the public. We fill up the entire day with them, repeating the same, you know, 5 or 10 stories that mean absolutely nothing, so that we can basically just bridge between one commercial break to the next. That's what it winds up becoming. And so I know a lot of people who have been in this business who are just fed up with it. They really hate the fact that they can't cover stories and they can't talk about anything of substance or value, that news managers won't allow it. But I think at the highest levels, as you know, on one hand, it was a money-making enterprise. On one hand, journalism became a value prospect for networks. We can make a bunch of money. But then at a certain point, it shifted. And there were those who began to see, hey, if we can influence with our advertising dollars what kind of stories are done, so that it's not simply a bridge from commercial break to commercial break, but instead the content itself reflects our worldview, whether they're, again, activists, whether they're big pharmaceutical companies, we can control the kind of content that shows up in a TV program or a news program. When you now have that power, you've done something very different. You've gone from losing your integrity to now being a corrupting, not just corrupted, but a corrupting force in the world. And that's where we are with media today. Media is the corruptor. It is the one that is going around trying to find people and convincing them that you know, up is down and down is up. I have a good friend who refers to it as upside downtown, right? That's where we are. Everything that is not, they claim is. And everything that is, they claim it is not. And I think that this COVID pandemic has unveiled a lot of that for people who had no idea, right? They didn't really recognize this was a problem. And it has awakened tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of people across the world. It's awakened them to just how not just corrupt and not just how corrupted, but how corrupting these forces are.
Mm. Interesting. I'll tell you two little quick stories, actually. I was asked to go on to 60 Minutes as a guest last year. It was probably 3 or 4 months into the pandemic, and they were doing a story on coronavirus or COVID-19 and conspiracy theories. And they asked me to start with, and I said, nah, that doesn't interest me. I know it'll be a hatchet job on me. And then I had the lead reporter, a woman called Liz Hayes, who is considered the queen of investigative journalism here in Australia. Most would regard her as the best journalist with integrity in Australia. And we had a chat on the over the telephone saying, I'll do the interview, I'll interview you. And I thought to myself, okay, well, if I'm going to be interviewed by someone, I'm happy to sit opposite the best in the business, you know, and hopefully they'll do their homework. And it was so fascinating because part of the agreement was I could bring in my own film team to film the whole interview and me to publish it in through my own network, because I knew they'd only put 5 or 10 minutes up. And it was so fascinating, and this is my perspective, how very little she knew about who was pulling the strings of the pandemic. Didn't know who Professor Neil Ferguson was from Oxford that had done the computer modeling. Didn't understand. It was such an eye-opener. And for the week leading up to it, I sent her and her producer a lot of information just so they were up to speed with where I would probably go to with the questions.
Yes.
They didn't read it. I'm pretty sure they didn't read anything. And it was just fascinating for me as the interviewee to understand how little that they actually knew about what this agenda actually was about. Yeah. And mm-hmm. and secondly, mm-hmm. when you're talking about mainstream television, I used to come to America every year in New York and go on the Today Show and cook. You know, I was one of yeah. I'd cook with all the hosts there, Matt Lauer and Al Roker, and the list goes on. And one year, a few years ago, after I released my documentary called The Magic Pill, which was about how food can be a medicine, they said, "We can't have you back on this program." And I said, "Why not?" They said, "You're too controversial." I said, "I'm cooking meat and vegetables as a chef." They said, and it was a great producer that I had a relationship with. She goes, "I've been told you're not allowed back onto the program because of your views." Mm-hmm. That was just so startling that they were so fearful yeah. of somebody like me cooking family food for their audience. So let's talk about the last 18 months.
Yeah.
Because one of the things I've noticed is there's no mainstream journalists that have asked a single decent question that I can see right. in this country. What's it like over there?
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. I mean, there aren't journalists who are asking these questions on mainstream. I would say that there is one news anchor here, Tucker Carlson, who's an opinion host on Fox, who has probably done more in terms of actually questioning things than just about anybody else in the mainstream. But other than him, he's like the one standout in my mind. Other than Carlson, nobody's really doing it because there is still a generally perceived acceptance that the mainstream has the willingness to talk about the truth. And the truth, according to them, is that this COVID pandemic began in a wet market. We don't really want to investigate where it originally came from, nor do we really want to acknowledge problems with vaccines. We don't want to acknowledge the vaccine failure that's taking place, or acknowledge the fact that there are people in this country and other countries around the world who have received two doses, in some cases three doses, who are still being hospitalized, and where the vaccine doesn't work. It doesn't prevent them from catching corona. It doesn't prevent them from spreading corona. So I think what's happening here is that there's no questioning of it because of the collusion between the big media companies and big tech. So the tech companies, Google, Amazon, Facebook, Twitter, they have all taken the stance that you are not allowed to question certain things because they call it medical misinformation. And so a lot of these networks refuse to question anything, even those who you would think, well, maybe they're going to push back, they won't. And the reason they won't is because they're terrified of being removed from social media, because that's where so many people see their content. So they are willing to bow to the overlords of big tech and allow big tech to decide what is considered true and what is not true in that, you know, public discourse.
Why does tech want to control this information? That's the next obvious question, is why them? And what do they have to get out of this?
Yeah, so you know, as a journalist, one of the things I find is that I don't always know the why, but it's not always my job to know the why, right? I hope to learn the why, but I can't know the why until I know the what. So, and the reason I say that is, so I don't know why, for instance, Google is working through YouTube to say, any medical misinformation will be removed, right? But here's what I do know. I know that YouTube says no medical misinformation will be allowed on our platform. No opinion or voice that contradicts the WHO or the CDC will be allowed on our platform. I was actually, as of today, I was deleted permanently from YouTube for something that I put up yesterday. And what I put up yesterday was literally reading from the CDC's website on a news hit that I was doing for a network, for RT. I was on their air reading from the CDC's website on the number of actual deaths related to kids between August of 2020 and August of 2021. By the way, in case you don't know, the number is 8 in the United States. 8 children died from COVID between August of 2020 and August of 2021. And yet they want 73 million school-aged children to be forcibly vaccinated against COVID. So because I shared this on the air, YouTube deleted my channel that's been up for 10 years, has hundreds of millions of views on it, and deleted it permanently as of today. And so I can't tell you why they did that, but I can tell you this, that if you look behind the scenes, Google is working very hard on adopting and taking a role in developing vaccines themselves, that they have moved into the creation of vaccines. In fact, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has talked about this quite extensively, that Google themselves, as a company, one of their new frontiers is vaccine development. And so is that part of the reason why? Perhaps it makes sense to me, but I can't tell you for sure why it's happening, but I can tell you that it's happening.
Yeah, scary stuff. Interestingly, there's a journalist in Australia who actually has integrity from my perception, a fellow called Denham Hitchcock, a very healthy specimen of a human being from all external appearances. Like he's built like Thor. Exactly. He looks after himself. And he just had a vaccine reaction where he got myocarditis, I think is the correct terminology. Yeah. And after his first shot, he's been in hospital. He was in hospital for weeks. And wow. And of all the people that could have happened to, the healthiest reporter that's probably on Australian television. And it'll be interesting to see where this goes with him, whether he takes a second shot, whether he starts asking questions as to why did this happen to him and why is it happening to others. The question a lot of people ask me, friends, family, is why do they want to get this vaccine? And the strange thing is there's 4 or 5 or 6 different types of vaccines.
Yes.
That seem to be interchangeable depending on which country you're in. What is the reason, again, going to the what or the why? Why do they want to get this into every single man, woman, and child globally? Because a lot of people go, oh, it must just be a money-making venture if it's for that. And that doesn't – I understand that it could be just about making profit, but for me it feels like there's something more. It doesn't make sense that it's just money. Yeah. Tell me your thoughts.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it is more than just making money. I think money's a big part of it. Obviously, you know, this – pandemic globally has minted dozens of new billionaires who never would have been billionaires without it. And it has shored up the wealth of existing billionaires to an incredible amount. So we've watched, you know, an enormous transfer of wealth that's taken place during this time. Well, here's what I believe. I believe that simultaneously you have multiple actors who are trying to take advantage of this moment for their own purposes. So in some cases, it's about making money. If you are a pharmaceutical executive, if you're, you know, running e-commerce, it's a chance to make much more money and have a much bigger company. So money is a part of it. But I believe that the push to forcibly inject the entire population of the world, that's really what we're talking about, right? We're talking about forcibly injecting the entire global population. I believe that is not about these vaccines, and I could be wrong. I do not believe it's about this particular situation. I believe it's about setting precedent for the future, that what is being created here is a blueprint, is a standard. And the reason I say that is if you go back 20 years ago, you know, to 9/11 here in the United States, our nation shifted so dramatically for the worse after 9/11. In terms of the creation of something called the Patriot Act, which was a law that was created here that basically threw out most of the Constitution. It completely and radically shifted what civil liberties actually meant in this country. And of course, once government takes authority over something, it never gives it back. It never restores order the way it was before. And so what I believe is happening right now for some, and I think for certainly for central planners who look at this idea of globalism and wanting to you know, dominate populations around the world. There are people who want that. And I believe that they see this as a blueprint, an opportunity to redefine kind of the order of the world and to forcibly put all people into situations where now there is a precedent. So when government mandates, hey, now you must do this, the entire population lines up and does it. And I think there are holdouts. So here in the United States, you know, there are 80 million people who have not been vaccinated at all. They've taken no shot at all. 80 million, I should say, adults, working age adults. Children have not been vaccinated against it yet here. But 80 million working age adults.
I really hope you enjoyed the first half of this podcast. If you'd like to listen to the rest, please visit evolvenetwork.tv. That's evolvenetwork.tv. We'll see you there.
The information, views, and opinions expressed in this podcast should not be treated as a substitute for nutritional, medical, or other advice by a qualified professional. Guests in this podcast express their own opinions, experiences, and conclusions. Nothing in this podcast should be used to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any medical condition. Neither Pete Evans nor any sponsor endorse any views, opinions, or conclusions expressed or shared in this podcast.